The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dan Coyce. Dan is the culture editor for Slate, where he also co-hosts the podcast Mom and Dad Are Fighting. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Dan, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thanks so much.
So I have to start this conversation by recalling that I sat with you and a number of your colleagues from Slate last fall, and we were talking about the upcoming primaries, and my recollection is no one in that room thought that Donald Trump was going to be the Republican nominee for president of the United States.
That is correct. So the context of that is that we were talking about the show that Slate and Second City have been putting together. Yeah. That process launched in the fall, and we got the whole politics staff together to talk about, you know, what are the stories we think will come out of this election. And yes, everyone unanimously believed that the one thing we didn't have to worry about was making a bunch of Donald Trump jokes.
Yes, I know. And what is so, you know, potentially disastrous for the country is just so good for comedy. So I hesitate to parse it too much, except I did find it fascinating in that conversation, which was great. And we were so enlightened, those of us from Second City who got to sit in on that talk. We were at the Kennedy Center. It was great. But this idea that Trump, who seemed like such a flash in the pan, is a pan and a flash that doesn't seem to go out.
Not yet, anyway. Yeah. I mean, who knows what the next 9 weeks holds. We're 9 weeks away from the election as of this recording. But the candidacy has made a real mockery of so-called experts like us.
Right.
And like everyone. And part of what has been so delicious about this candidacy, if you set aside any personal feelings you might have about Trump or political feelings about his beliefs, is that there is a certain pleasure to seeing the conventional wisdom being so, so wrong,
yeah,
so hilariously overturned by a candidate whose entire stance essentially is everyone's wrong about me except me.
Right. And the election feels incredibly theatrical. I'm just thinking like the last couple of days, right? Hillary Clinton's coughing fit, Pastor Mark Burns walking out on a CNN interview after they exposed this extremely exaggerated biography, Trump's visit to Mexico. I mean, all of it feels incredibly new, like none of this would have existed in any other cycle, in any other election.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, the lesson we took from the spring as we were making this show in the summer was this is the election that suggests that all rules are off, that everything that that in a previous presidential election would have decreed you unelectable, that would have caused you to be tossed out on your ear, now was like it's like a blip on the radar. It gets covered so quickly and people move on so quickly to the next thing that you do or say that essentially it seems like there is no such thing as a disqualifying statement or fact or revelation. We're living in an election in which every day is a new October surprise, and it's not even October yet.
Yeah, it's so funny too. Matt Hovde, who is the director of the show, and Dan is a consultant, creative consultant on the show. You know, Matt was the one who directed a show called Between Barack and a Hard Place before anyone who knew who Barack Obama was. He seems to have this tendency of being somewhat ahead of the game, and. While certainly, you know, politics is something we can talk about, one of the things I've been fascinated about, because I've been listening to your
your podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting. And back in March on that podcast, you talked about how parents might talk to their kids about Donald Trump. And you noted in your house, at that time at least, Trump was like a delight. I think you quoted him as a delightful cartoon villain who hadn't really turned into a real villain yet. Has that changed? I mean, how do you talk to your kids about Trump now?
They understand a little more that he is a real human being in the world who has the potential to wreak a great deal of mischief on the lives of many. Mm-hmm. But he is still so much larger than life. I mean, even to adults, that to children, he still exists in the way that sort of all public figures do, as a set of archetypes that they understand sort of as real people, but also as characters who match up to people they know from the pop culture they love, right? He's like, he's Yosemite Sam, and then he's a blustery blowhard, and he's kind of a little foghorn leghorny, and he is, he's a little bit like the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Like, there's just these, there are these character traits that he has that they understand, that he plays the same role in many people's lives as those characters do. But I don't think most parents still at this point are like telling their kids, this election's going to change everything. And if it goes wrong, get ready, kids, you're eating gruel for 4 years. You know, I think most parents tend to, when current events seem dire or difficult, we tend to try to soften that a little bit when we talk to our kids.
Right.
At least I do. I think most parents do. And there's a time for straight talk and real talk, and maybe that time is election day.
Yeah.
Maybe we won't be able to stop ourselves on election day. We will be so overjoyed or disconsolate that our children will notice, as children often do, and we'll have to deal with it then.
It's funny. I just dropped my oldest son off at college this last week.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much. And it was a momentous occasion. But two things that I did talk to him about, and I've made no qualms on this podcast about me being, you know, left and liberal, of course, you know, and theater kid living in Chicago. But I recalled when I went to college, the two things that were going on was the Cubs were in first place and were probably about to elect Ronald Reagan, which seemed like, you know, the best thing in the world and the worst thing in the world at the time to me. And as I'm dropping Nick off at Skidmore in Saratoga Springs, the Cubs are in first place and Donald Trump is, you know, starting to launch himself in the polls. And what I basically said to him was, you know, the Cubs lost and the world didn't end. And maybe those are the two things I'm sure of in the world that are going to happen.
Right. Yeah, Reagan won, the world didn't end, the Cubs lost. It felt like the world was going to end
for a while, but
you eventually gain perspective. When they lose this year, it's going to feel even worse.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you.
I know. At least they're young. You know, one of the things, too, that's interesting about this cycle as it relates to children, and you have girls, right?
Yeah, two girls, 9 and 11.
Yeah. So my daughter is 14, and I'm absolutely thrilled that she has a chance to see a female candidate for president. It's just been, you know, incredible for her to grow up in a world where that's just a thing and not necessarily a special thing. But I've been, like, really surprised at the lack of attention and conversation around the rampant sexism that's at play in this cycle. What do you think about that?
In the context of talking about it with my kids, it's a very – I mean, especially with my older daughter, it's a very prevalent thing. She's very alert and awake to sexism.
Yep.
She gets very upset vicariously about the sexism that she sees in the world, whether or not it directly affects her.
Yep.
And she is eager, I think, to see the way that she sees Hillary Clinton being treated in multiple contexts as evidence of sexism, even in cases where I don't believe it to be evidence of sexism.
Mm.
You know, our family is a family that prizes press freedom and investigative journalism quite a bit. I'm a journalist. My wife is a First Amendment attorney who often represents news organizations that are trying to shake information loose from the government.
Right.
And so the Hillary email scandal has been something that has really bugged both of us.
Right.
It's our least favorite thing about Hillary Clinton. Not really. We don't care so much about the classified information being sent, you know, over private lines as much as we care about the fact that a whole system was set up specifically to avoid oversight, you know, and so that bugs us. And when we complain about that in the House, then, you know, our daughter will be like, that's so sexist. And we're like, that literally is not, that has nothing to do with sexism.
Yeah, right.
Kid, like, that's not the way it is.
Yeah.
For our younger daughter, it's been very interesting to see the way in which, for her, the revelations about Hillary Clinton happened in reverse. First, she was excited that there was a woman like her who was running for president. Mm-hmm. But she didn't understand that that was uncommon. And it was only after, like, some talk about Hillary that it dawned on us that we needed to convey to her that, in fact, that had never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like, the mind blower for her. It was not a mind blower that a woman was running for president. It was a mind blower that such a thing could not have happened before. Like, what kind of stupid fucking world did we live in?
Right.
That was the case.
Uh-huh. Of course.
And so that was, like, that was her big shocker. And so she, I think, is still coming to grips with that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the bullying aspect as well, I think, is what my daughter responds to the most, because both my kids have experienced bullying, and both of them came out of it at different times. And that's sort of, you know, an improvisation. One of the great things about improvisation is it builds resiliency, because you are just failing constantly.
Right.
And
you're transforming failures into successes. Like, that's the entire purpose of a scene.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a really good, you know, experiencing that, the getting knocked down, getting back up, getting knocked down, backed up. You know, I think for a lot of kids, they get that in sports. But if you're not so inclined, where are you going to get it? And on one of your recent podcasts, you guys were telling stories about the first night of parenthood. And mm-hmm. one of your guests was reflecting on his crying newborn being taken out of the room. He sort of instructed the nurses to take him out of the room so he and his wife could get some sleep. And his first thought is that, like, the deepest regret he ever had that he did it. But later, recognizing that a lot of your parenting is like letting yourself off the hook for that stuff. And this is the thing I love about your podcast, which is you guys, like, you bring up all the parenting fails. It's like a nonstop failure parade of your parenting.
We prize ourselves on the quality of our fails. We judge each other harshly if our fails are not up to snuff. Yeah, I mean, I do think that part of the spirit of the podcast is this sense that that everyone is making it up as they go along, that pretty much everyone believes themselves to be screwing up all the time,
mm-hmm.
and that letting yourself off the hook for those screw-ups, or at the very least understanding them and feeling at peace with them, is the most valuable thing a parent can do for him or herself. That's the way to sort of survive the emotional roller coaster that starts the first time you send your kid out of the room on the first night in the hospital. Like,
right.
that's not an uncommon feeling. Hearing you mention, you know, that you had gone through, that your kids have both gone through bullying,
yep.
reminds me of, like, the sort of whole new set of challenges and difficulties that you don't even think about when you first become a parent. Like, when you first become a parent, and on that first day and in the first years, your concerns about your kid are very physical and immediate. And are they, am I failing because I'm not teaching my child this thing, or because she can't read, or because she had a dirty diaper for an hour and I didn't even notice it, or mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, as they become cognizant human beings who are self-sustaining in the world, those really transfer to much more emotionally fraught situations, like this other kid is being mean to my kid, and what do I do to help her? And also, what do I do about my own crazy feelings about how I want to kill this other kid? And those all come from my being bullied when I was a kid. And like, boy, that the cans of worms that get opened up every day are amazing and rewarding in many ways. Like, it's for, you know, for those of us who went through our 20s, you know, drunk or watching TV, it's incredible to feel so many things at once. Who knew you could?
Right.
But wow, it's exhausting.
Well, some of this stuff doesn't change, and so you have to relearn it over and over. So when I was listening to the podcast, and the minute this guy said that thing about the regret he felt sending his kid out of the room, I immediately flashed on the moment, which was like literally 3 days earlier, because I listened to it like three days ago, when, you know, my son is in the commons area and my wife and I are like, okay, we're going. And he just kind of looks at us and goes, ah, it's a lot. and put his hands on his head. Like, it's a lot. And I just, like, I fist bumped him. I don't know that that was appropriate. And I walked away. And it was like, I think I described it as someone's like having an anvil just dropped on your heart. And Ann and I are both sort of walking away, not even quietly sobbing, rather publicly sobbing, and getting in the car and going, we can't go back. We can't go back. We can't go back. And it was the same thing. It was the same thing as letting the kid cry earlier. And, you know, cut to last night, you know, I'm asleep. Ann gets a call from Nick. They're having a great conversation. Stuff's going great. He's having a good time. He's already learning stuff. You know, and you just had to kind of make it through. So it's almost like these measured, you know, take it in chunks, because it's going to be hard, and it doesn't stop becoming hard.
When you got in the car and started driving away, what song was on the radio? Was it Everybody Hurts? It seems like it should have been Everybody Hurts.
It really should have been. No, I think we were listening to J.K. Rowling's mystery novel. So I think immediately that, or like my wife's iPod is such that Vampire Weekend comes on no matter when we get in the car. And it's just like, and I love the song, but it's now an annoying riff that sort of came to us. But I will say, it's not like I didn't hear, you know, Father and Son by Peter Gabriel, or, you know, some Cat Stevens or Harry Chapin song, and then start, you know, to go there. But one has to measure their how much input they want with regard to that media when they're dealing with all those emotions.
I think a lot about something that my wife said very early in our parenting days, which is that we spend a lot of our time with our kids trying to be in the moment and battling what we refer to as preemptive nostalgia, which is the sense that we are having during a nice moment that we can't stop reminding ourselves of, that one day this will be the thing we look back on and think, oh,
yeah,
our daughter's childhood. Like we can't stop thinking, like, preemptively feeling sad about what we will miss one day about our lives now. And, you know, we often joke that we sort of wish that when we were, you know, 25 and we watched The Truman Show, it seemed like a dystopic nightmare. And when we're parents and we watch The Truman Show, it seems aspirational. Like, oh, that would be great if we could put that many cameras on our kid. And then later have a 24-hour-a-day record of our kid's childhood that we could go back and revisit when we are in the nursing home and have nothing better to do.
You know what I'm curious about? So you and your wife, both professionals in your industry, same with my wife and myself. And when I wrote my book on improvisation in the business world, I started talking to a lot of groups. I'd go around and, you know, speak at conventions and, you know, ideas festivals and that sort of thing. And invariably, I would bring up the fact that my wife and I would use a lot of these improv techniques when we were raising our kids. So to get them to be better listeners, we would play the game One Word Story around the table, where everyone had to say a story one word at a time. And what always happened is after this, I'd end the speech, that's all anyone wanted to talk to me about was the parenting thing. And so I've really spent the last few years, I'm sort of curious when this flipped with you, which is that indeed in my workplace, there seems to be a great interest in parenting and child rearing, and that's become less of a thing that's sort of separate from your work life, but ingrained and integrated into your work life in a way that is kind of healthy and smart and instructive, because I think there's a level of bad parenting and good parenting that we see in the workplace all the time ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has something to do with moving up the ladder a little bit, right? Like when I was, you know, when I was 28 or 29 and in offices where no one had kids, or at least no one in my immediate cohort, people at my level, no one had kids, like parenting wasn't a concern. And those people in the office who had parents were like the weirdos who made our lives more difficult by leaving at 6 for their kids' soccer game or whatever.
Right.
You know, that, and so that was when I was a blogger or a writer or an assistant or a junior agent at all the various places that I've worked. And now, now I'm an editor and the people at my level have kids. And so it has become reasonable among all of us who have kids, who are also thoughtful people who want to work in a humane environment, to really think about and talk about those decisions and those challenges. I know that there's an entire cohort in my company of younger writers and junior staffers and assistants for whom we are now the annoying ones.
Yes, exactly.
Who are out at six to like get to our kid's softball game, or who didn't answer a Slack because we were taking our kids to school or whatever. And so I don't know. It's hard for me to track whether that change is like a true environmental change in the American workplace, or if it just represents me just sort of achieving this level of agedness that allows me to finally be privy to the discussions that were happening 10 years ago, but I just didn't know anything about.
I think it's probably the latter. You're probably right. I was talking to I don't know if he calls himself a futurist. I think he does. A guy works for a company called Futures, J. Walker Smith, and he talks about when you look at different generations, the generational differences are more about starting points. What's going on in the environment when that generation started? That's the real change. The other stuff kind of remains the same. It's just that maybe, it's longer till they get married, or it's longer till they get a house. But they're going to go through a lot of the same stuff every generation does. So, right. I think that that's probably the case. And I talked about earlier the sort of game playing that we did with our kids and that we can actually continue to do. And you actually created a game I read online called Ace
That's
of Hate.
True.
Yeah,
it's America's favorite family card game.
Is that what it is? That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. It's number one in America. this is a game that we played, that I played with our kids, and that we played with my wife's brother, that we had just sort of invented, I think before we even had kids, when we were sitting around on a vacation and it was raining and we had nothing to do and we were sick of spades and we were sick of hearts and we were sick of Oh Hell and we were sick of Euchre and we were sick of all the card games we knew. And so with a deck of cards, we invented this game called Ace of Hates, in which a player draws a card. They see the number on the card, which represents a certain level of affection or hatred in their lives. And then they come up with something that corresponds to that. So if I get like the five of hearts, that represents a little bit of love. And I might then say, okay, peaches, but not all the way ripe, just like almost ripe peaches. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so then everyone around the table guesses, okay, well, that feels like a 10 of loves to me. You really love peaches. Oh, that feels like a 3 of hates. That annoys you that it's not quite right.
Right,
yet.
Right.
And the person who knows me the best, who knows my likes and dislikes the best, who guessed closest to the card that I was holding in my hand, wins the card. So we took that game in the spirit of many successful card games and board games. We took something that was basically invented to be done while drinking,
right,
and trademarked it and attempted to make money off of it. So I made my own Ace of Hates decks, which you now can order at aceofhates.com. I would say that I've not yet met my stated goal of becoming a hundredaire.
Okay.
But I have lost less than $1,000 on Ace of Hates.
Oh, so that's pretty good.
I would declare it a huge success.
Yes. Well, and
I imagine it'll have an enormous long tail.
Oh, especially after this podcast.
Absolutely. Yeah,
this is where people – this is Game Central. This is exactly where they're coming.
They refer to this as the tipping point in the marketing.
Yes, I think so.
I want to go back to something you were talking about, though, which I think we were sort of still talking about before I got in my plug. Thank you for that.
Sure.
But which is about the role that that improv and the tenets of improv can have in parenting.
Yeah.
The way that I find that applies the most to me as a former longtime improviser is that I do my best parenting, and my interaction with my kids is the most rewarding and satisfying and the least frustrating when I essentially yes and my way through interactions.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean always giving them what they want. It doesn't mean never taking authority over situations that require it, but it does mean getting rid of this thing that I find I often naturally would do when my kids would make requests, which was to just like give a knee jerk no.
Yep.
Dad, can I da 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 da? Oh, no, that. And I would say that. And when I would interrogate it a little bit, I would realize I was saying no because it seemed like a minor pain in my ass,
mm-hmm,
or like I had something else on my mind and I wasn't even listening that much. Or just for whatever reason, that was my immediate response. And I have found that the kid actually wants the thing and you realize you don't actually care that much, but then you feel stuck because you know that you're not supposed to go back on a decision and reward their whining or whatever. And it's like it ends up being a dumb and frustrating interaction all around. But instead, I have found that when I'm really listening in the way that you listen in an improv scene, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm really trying to find the kernel of truth in what they're saying and what is really interesting to them, and trying to play upon that and expand upon it and remain open and accepting to the various possibilities that might spin out from what essentially is an offer that they have made. That's when parenting feels rewarding, and specifically when interactions between me and my kids feel rewarding. When I'm not pursuing my own objective, whatever it might be, typically my own laziness, at the expense of collaborating with them to like actually have a human interaction. Like, that is when I find it is rewarding. And obviously that's generally true of life,
right?
And it's true in business, and it's true in creativity, and it's true in creative collaboration. But it feels really true in family interaction and parenting, because kids tend to make such surprising moves, you know, in the way that a really good player who you're on stage with makes mm-hmm. surprising moves on stage. And the more open you are to those, the more fun you're going to have. Kids make really surprising moves. They make dumb suggestions that turn out to be great. They mm-hmm. make suggestions that are free of a lot of preconceived notions about the way things ought to work. Mm-hmm. And the more open that I am to them, the more open I can allow myself to be to their crazy moves, the more rewarding those interactions tend to be.
Yeah, well, and two things about that. A yes-and approach promotes critical thinking. It requires you to go a few more layers than the simple no, because then the no just brings why. You know, and then you're suddenly in the worst improv scene you've ever been in,
right,
which is all
right.
Questions, right? All the shit that they teach you not to say. Whereas when you do, and I've had this on a number of occasions, and believe me, I'm bad at this at home. You know, I try, and we all do, and try to remember to be, but there's plenty of no in my household. But when I'm at my best and I'm saying sort of yes and to kind of a crazy idea, and it actually happened last night, Eleanor decided that she wanted to go to the Walgreens to get some photos made from her phone, and it was like 8 o'clock and I was sort of winding down.
That's a classic knee-jerk no.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And the Walgreens is not far away. And so I sort of said, well, yes, and you're going to have to pay with your own money. And she's like, yep, I've got that. I've got my own money. Okay, now I'm in it. And I'm like, okay. And ended up doing it. And we actually had a nice time in the car. Then we had to go back later because the pictures weren't going to be ready. When we got back, all the lights were out at the Walgreens. I'm like, why is the Walgreens closed at 8:30? Which it wasn't. There was a power outage in the neighborhoods. So we got to experience the power. And I'm like, we just had an adventure together the night before the first day of class, you know, at school, which is kind of what I think she was craving for anyway. This is the thing about that you start to realize, you're like, she didn't really care about the pictures. She wanted to have an event to signify the end of summer, and I was about to deny it because I'd rather sit and watch the Cubs get, you know, killed by the Brewers, which I didn't. And the other thing about yes and is that if you do need to get to know, it's a really lovely way to get there because
yes, that's really true.
Yeah, you circumvent, and everyone feels like, well, I got yes, you know, they took me seriously. They thought we talked about, okay, we're fine, we're at no. So you've just said, you know, I usually set up the yes and story, but you delivered it, you know, unbidden, which is you certainly, you know, drawing on your improv background. I have a couple of little things I want to ask you about. Do you still make your own beef jerky?
I got a dehydrator that I use so enthusiastically that I effectively destroyed my desire for beef jerky.
Really?
And I, in fact, have now not made beef after basically making beef jerky every day for 4 months in this dehydrator and eating almost nothing but beef jerky. I sort of like,
you can't do it.
It's like when a kid smokes one cigarette and you make them smoke a whole pack. I ate a whole pack of beef jerky and now I can't take it anymore.
That's a bit of a shame. Do you dehydrate other stuff?
I dehydrated some fruit, but it tasted like beef.
It tasted like
because of what I had done with that
jerky.
Dehydrator.
You sullied the dehydrator with beef jerky. Oh, my God. All right. Yeah. Well, that's a good – all right. And the one other thing, because this is the thing, when you Google Dan Coyce, you find out a lot of weird facts.
Yeah, boy, I'm glad you did your research.
You stopped sitting for an entire month.
I did, yes.
Why? Why would you do that?
Well, because a magazine, a guy in a magazine
paid
was going to pay me money. Yeah. Well, the reason that that story came about because of the many, many studies that have happened that scientists have done that suggest that the more you stand over the course of a day, the better your health will be. And the more you sit, the sooner you will die. And so we thought me and an editor at New York Magazine thought it would be fun to take that to its illogical extreme, right? What is your life like if you embrace this this idea and this experience and this recommendation and just never sit down? You restrict yourself from sitting down. So the only time I was allowed to sit down over the course of that month was to go to the bathroom and to drive. I was allowed to sit to drive, and that was it. And I did not sit any other time. I stood in restaurants. I stood in movies. I stood at the office. I stood recording podcasts, which led to me often standing when I record podcasts, although I am sitting now because I brought my laptop in and needed to look at stuff.
Okay.
But I often now stand while recording podcasts because I find that useful. But yeah, the idea was, what happens if you take this to its extreme? And the answer was, your feet really hurt a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You lose weight. I lost like 10 pounds.
Jeez. That's a simple one.
And also you become very cognizant of the various social codes around power and sitting. You become that guy in the meeting who's like standing and pacing, and it seems like a power move. You become a big pain in the ass to your friends at restaurants and social events. You become very restless, and you find it in the end, though you are in better physical health, you have a harder time focusing on things, because the longer you stand there typing or editing or writing, the more you can only think about how your calves hurt so much.
Mm-hmm.
And who knew your calves could hurt like that?
Mm-hmm.
But it was a worthwhile and fun, stupid investigation into a thing that we all sort of know, which is that the more sedentary we are, the more awful our life is. But it's nice to know that you can be a little too active.
Yeah, I think your status discovery is kind of cool. My wife does a thing with her students where she has them go to a downtown restaurant, stand sort of in the doorway, look at the different tables, and figure out who the boss is, all by body language. And,
oh, that's fun.
And it's real easy. That's the thing that's hilarious, because they're the ones leaning back, not nodding, or they're the ones standing, or they're on the phone, you know, while other people are there. But very much this idea of the way you put your body forward in any situation is giving off a status thing, whether you mean it or not. And I think just by you doing it for completely other reasons, recognizing that that's at play suddenly in a room. And I could see how that would work in the conference room, where everyone would be like, oh, Jesus, that, you know, Dan's going to pontificate now because he's standing.
Right.
Wow.
Well, and those were situations where I wasn't necessarily the power figure in the room. I was one of the cogs in the room.
Right.
And so, like, I just ended up in the end, like, explaining to a lot of people this stupid thing that I was doing for a
and Julia
magazine.
Turner's like, would you sit down?
Right. Well, just so I wouldn't like, right. So I wouldn't be, so it would be distracting, but in a different way. Like, it's still distracting to have to think about this thing that I'm doing, but at least the distraction is not coming from believing that I have walked into this meeting thinking that I am the boss.
Right. Right, right.
When in fact I'm aware that I'm not the boss.
Yeah, well, that's an improv thing too, right? I mean, you're part of the ensemble, and that means sometimes you are the boss, and sometimes you aren't the boss. And the idea of giving and taking with regard to that, whether it's status or position or authority, is kind of vital in terms of groups that want to work well together. It's those who hold all the power at one end or surrender all the power at the other end that doesn't work so well. And I could tie this back
groups,
to
groups that can easily shift status from person to person. And can invert status quickly and painlessly in improv, as well as in at least in my business world, in the magazine world. Like, that's a really valuable skill for a group to have, to recognize when a different person is the right person to take charge on a moment to moment or a day to day or week to week basis is a way that a group remains flexible and successful usually.
Yeah, and completely missing in our political conversation on both sides.
Well, sure.
And that really is. It's the dysfunction that we're seeing.
I alone can change it, I believe the message we're getting.
I alone can change it. And it's on the other side, too. I mean, this is the – I remember that conversation we had, you know, in Washington last fall where you guys are like, the Obama administration is the least transparent administration in the history of the White House.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Having to take that moment going, oh, my God, they're right. And if Hillary Clinton is elected, it will be the second most non-transparent administration ever. And
it'll
that's
be a close battle. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a problem as well. Dan Coyes can be found at Slate.com. His fingerprints are all over Unelectable You, which starts its national tour in Ohio next week. Great place start it. And his podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, is also at Slate. You got to check it out. It's really smart. It's really funny, and for parents, it'll give you a lot of relief. Dan, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.